We're going to do this week a psalm discussion in honor of the Jewish holiday, minor Jewish holiday, that is happening in the calendar this weekend. For the past 3 weeks, including today, the Haftorah reading, the reading from the prophets, has been passages from Isaiah and Jeremiah warning, dire warning, Israel of their sins. It's the most graphic, it's the most intense Haftorah readings in the annual cycle. It is 3 weekends of warning that will be followed beginning next Sabbath with 7 weeks of comfort. I like that the comfort is more than double the warning, but we are in concluding now the 3 weeks of admonition and warning. What this leads up to is a Jewish holiday called Tish B'Av, which means the ninth day of the month of Av. The ninth day of the month of Av is actually today, but because this is a Shabbat and that holiday is normally a holiday of regret and mourning and lamenting, which things are not appropriate on the Sabbath to do. It's actually put off until tomorrow. So the ninth of Av really comes on the 10th of Av, at least when it falls on a Sabbath. The holiday commemorates biblically the destruction of the temple that Solomon built by Nebuchadnezzar, destroyed about 400 years later, and it occurred in the story in Jeremiah. It occurred at this time of year. It occurred on the ninth and the 10th of Av. It just so happens that then another 500, actually closer to 600 years later, the second temple that was built was also destroyed, this time by the Romans, was destroyed at the exact same time period. Summertime, the month of Av, actually the Romans had set siege to the city of Jerusalem about 2 days before Passover started that year. This is in the year 70. You know, this is 2018. That was the year 70. So in the year 70, the Romans had set siege to Jerusalem 2 days before Passover started. And Passover, of course, is a pilgrimage holiday. And there were people from all over that had converged in Jerusalem to observe the holiday. And that's when the Romans decided to barricade and siege the city. Finally, through skirmishes, pitched battles, and so forth, from the springtime until the late summer, the inhabitants of Jerusalem tried to fight off the Romans, and bit by bit, the Romans conquered the city of Jerusalem, setting siege to some of the final defenders at the Antonia Fortress and the temple right there next to each other. And on the 8th, 9th, and 10th of Av, the temple was attacked and burnt to the ground. Josephus, the Jewish historian tells us that literally hundreds of thousands of our Jewish people died in the siege of Jerusalem. And coincidentally, or maybe not coincidentally, it fell at the exact same time period when the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians, the first temple, hundreds of years earlier. Other disasters have befallen our people at this time of year. The Jews were expelled from England on the 9th of Av. The Jews were expelled from Spain in the Inquisition on the 9th of Av, 1492. Interestingly, it was the same week that Columbus sailed for the New World. The same week, if you can think in your history terms, that the Jews were kicked out of Spain. Columbus led to something we would consider joyful, but that was also a painful week for our people in the Inquisition. As recently as 2005, in Israel, there at this time, the 9th and 10th of Av, have been periods of sorrow. And why do these things have to happen on this date? It's interesting that the Romans destroyed, sacked, looted the city of Jerusalem. They took the prizes from the Jewish temple some of them, like the golden menorah. Interestingly, the Ark of the Covenant was never in the second temple, but the golden menorah was. And the Romans took it back to Rome and paraded it through the streets of Rome. And to this day, you can go to Rome and see the Arch of Titus, which has this engraving on it. There you see the Romans victoriously carrying some of the treasures from the Jewish temple. This is one of those triumphal arches, you know, over a boulevard. You can walk down a street in Rome this very day and see this that was built. Yes, I see that hand.
When were they expelled from England again?
13th century.
Okay,
every country in Europe, at some point in their history, expelled the Jewish people. There were no Jews allowed in England for about 300 years, until the time of Cromwell, I believe, when the Jews were allowed to return. To put it a different way, every country that's had a significant Jewish population has at some point in their history expelled them. There's only one exception to that. I'll let you ponder what that might be. But you happen to live in that country. The United States is the only country that's had a significant Jewish population that at some point has not expelled them, you know, forced them to leave. So so here's a wider shot of the Arch of Titus. Titus was the name of the Roman general, the son of the emperor who conquered Jerusalem in the year 70. The money that Titus took back to Rome was vast. that came from Jerusalem. And do you know what they did with the money that they stole from Jerusalem? They started in the year 70, they started a building project in Rome. It took them about 10 years to build, but you can still see that today too. Next shot, Maestro. The Colosseum in Rome was built with, began being built in the year 70 from the proceeds and funds that came out of the Jewish land home in Jerusalem. So when your friends talk about the Colosseum or talk about Rome, or you go to Rome and you see the Colosseum, remember that this was built on the backs of Jewish slaves. Josephus says there were about 100,000 Jewish slaves that Rome took back from Jerusalem and Judah. This is why the holiday Tish B'Av exists in our annual cycle. It's not one of the holidays prescribed by Moses, but you do read about it in the book of Zechariah. It talks about the fasts that come in particular months, including the month of Av. Traditionally, for traditional communities, the ninth day of Av is a day of fasting. It's the other L book. Lamentations. Lamentations is read on the ninth of Av, and it includes such painful comments as, "God, you have changed our dancing into mourning." Earlier, we read from Psalm 30. How God has clothed us with joy. He's changed our mourning into dancing. But Lamentations very ironically twists that and says that our dancing has changed to mourning. And it's a cry. It's a cry for what has been lost and the pain that has happened. So with that, let's consider Psalm 79 and Psalm 74. Two psalms I want to highlight. In fact, could I have someone read the first four verses of Psalm 79. Anybody? Okay. Yes. God, your enemies, the nations, have invaded your inheritance and defiled your holy temple. In Psalm 74, the history is told like this. Psalm 74, the enemy, in verse 3, the enemy has damaged everything within the sanctuary. Your adversaries have roared in the middle of your meeting place. They have set up their own standards. It seems as if one had lifted up his axe in the forest of trees, and now all its carved work they smash with hatchets and hammers. They have burned your sanctuary to the ground. They have defiled the dwelling place of your name. The Psalms we often think of as books, as chapters and poems of beauty and praise, and that's how we read them in our liturgy. About 12, 15 different psalms are read on the Sabbath liturgy prayers dealing with praise. But did you know there's actually more psalms that deal with struggle than with praise? There are more psalms that deal with suffering and pain or sorrow or loss than deal with gladness or transformation or joy. It's interesting that the Psalms cover such a breadth of emotion. It really covers our everyday life experience. I like to think of it this way. The Psalms are the life of our people Israel in poetry. The struggles, the joys, the remembering the mighty things that God has done in the past. And the fact that in the present, we're not there. We're not achieving our purpose and our identity. We're not able to press forward into the legacy that God has for us as his inheritance. The Psalms are the songs of the vicissitudes and the ups and downs and the curves of the people of Israel. That's why they can speak to so many people wherever that they are in life. In these two psalms, though, both psalms, by the way, are titled that they are written by Asaph, who was actually a grandson of the prophet Samuel. If I have my details straight. He was a priest who was one of the psalm writers. If they are by him, these psalms are written not only before the Romans destroyed the second temple, they were written before the Romans the Babylonians destroyed the first temple. In that case, they take on a very unique aspect of understanding what life will be, not just where life is at. In any case, even if they are contemporary with the exile and the destruction of the first temple, they express such grief. Could I have someone read verse 5 of Psalm 74? These psalms pour out all kinds of question words. Why? How long? For what? Lama, Adma. In Psalm 74, the questions go like this. God, why have you rejected us forever? Why does your smoke Why does your anger smoke against the sheep of your pasture? Remember your congregation, which you purchased of old, which you redeemed. But down in verse 10 of Psalm 74, we're back to the pain, the struggle. How long, O God, will the adversary revile and the enemy spurn your name? Why do you withdraw your hand, even your right hand? How long and why? And what is this about? Words that are contemplated, themes that are addressed on the ninth day of Av. In fact, the book of Lamentations in Hebrew is called Echa. Echa, it means how. It's the first word of the book. How desolate is Jerusalem sitting here? She used to be the queen, but how things have changed. How and why and how long, God? And in our lives, through the struggles, the paths, we come to this sort of thing in our lives as well. Why was the temple's destroyed? Why did they have to be destroyed if they were God's dwelling place? Part of the answer is this. Jeremiah tells us, he was a prophet that lived at the time when the first temple was destroyed. Jeremiah tells us that there were three sins that caused the destruction of the first temple. Murder, idolatry, and sexual promiscuity. Sexual promiscuity, idolatry, and murder. Blatant things, all of which destroy the foundation of who God is in our lives, of who God is in our life, in the collective life of His people. They underroot the very society that God is in relationship with. Indeed, they're all even spoken about in the Decalogue, in the Ten Commandments. Sexuality, idolatry, and murder. Karen and I, a number of years ago, with some of you in our congregation, took a field trip. We went to Cincinnati to see the Dead Sea Scroll exhibit. And part of that exhibit included some of the little figurines, we might call them. What they were really were like little idols, little household deities that were found not in Canaanite excavation of Canaanite cities, but in excavation of Jewish cities during the time of the first temple. And you get this in, if you read about Elijah, for instance, who lived during the time of the first temple. There was this struggle. Elijah was like, if this, who are you going to serve? And if you want Baal, if you want the heathen deity, the storm god, the rain god, which, by the way, interestingly, couldn't make it rain because Elijah had said it won't rain for 3 years. And then worship him. And there was this struggle in the hearts and the lives of our people in the first temple period toward the Most High. All the prophets of that period talked about their idolatry. It's really amazing, though, in the prophets from the Second Temple period, even in your Bible, you'll find that those prophets don't talk about idolatry. Those little household teraphim, the little idols that would be found in people's homes, disappear. The exile, the destruction of the first temple, and the subsequent 70-year exile had brought a realization and understanding. We were able to grow and learn from our mistakes. So why was the second temple destroyed? If idolatry and these things had stopped, then why did God allow the Romans to destroy the next temple? It's a very interesting answer that is given in Jewish tradition. The answer is baseless hatred. Hatred for each other. Not murder. Hatred. Isn't it interesting that the book of Leviticus ties together anger and murder in Leviticus chapter 19? Yeshua does it in the Drash on the Mountain, the Sermon on the Mount. He talks about how we are guilty of murder if we allow hatred to grow in our heart. It's interesting, though, that in Jewish tradition, it's not even hatred that is focused hatred. It's just general hatred. Groundless, baseless. Hatred that's not even really rooted in anything. It's just a hateful spirit that really isn't responding to something in a just something that needs justice, but it's just a spirit of anger or a spirit of superiority, a spirit that says, I don't need anybody else, that kind of disdains others. This was the reason that the second temple was destroyed. The things that grow in our lives, not just the outward things, our sexuality, our bumping off our neighbors, those things, those are very external. But we can nurse anger and hatred in our lives. It's much more covert. It can remain hidden. I can let this kind of sit there and really not choose to deal with it. But it brought down Jerusalem. And there has never been a Jewish temple in Jerusalem since then. The exile after the first temple lasted 70 years. The exile after the second temple has lasted nearly 2,000. Be careful of the spirit and the attitude that we allow to reside within us. Back to Psalm 74 and 79. In Psalm 74, we have this interesting quote the enemy makes in verse 8. They say in their heart, let's completely get them. Well, something like that. Let's totally wipe them out. In verse 8, but in Psalm 79, it's interesting that there's a quote there as well from the enemies. In Psalm 79, would someone read verse 10?
How long, O God, will the tormentor revile? Will the foe blaspheme your name forever?
Are you in Psalm 79? Okay, somebody. Okay, I'll do it. Why should the nation say, where is their God? Where is their God? It's interesting, this relationship, our actions are visible to the nations around us. If Israel's job is to be the light of the nations, when God's people don't walk the way that God desires, it makes God look bad to the outsiders, right? The nations look and say, where's their God at? Look what's happening. Where's their God at? What kind of light can Israel be in this kind of situation? Going back up to verse 8, Psalm 79, verse 8. Would someone read that verse, please?
Do not hold against us the sins of our fathers. May your mercies come quickly to meet us, for we have brought very low.
Don't remember. God, don't remember the sins of our fathers. And in Psalm 74, and now I forgot what verse it was. There's a similar prayer of forgiveness. For our misdeeds, for our shortfalls. God, forgive. So the first is that our actions bring about the loss of God's dwelling in our presence. We can step forward with a heart of repentance, seeking forgiveness. It's interesting that there in Psalm 79, the poet asks, God, forgive the sins of our parents, this legacy that we carry. And create something new in us. But then there's one more thing that I want to highlight. And this is in Psalm 74. Would someone read verse 12 in Psalm 74? God has been my king from earliest times, literally Mekedem, from old, from ancient days. And he works to make deeds of deliverance and salvation through all the earth. This verse, very interestingly, comes in the exact middle of Psalm 74. There are 11 verses before it, and there are 11 verses after it. In Hebrew, it's in, if you're right out the lines, it's the very middle line of the psalm. And I mention that because of its unique position. And it sounds suddenly unlike anything we've read. God, you are my king. God, you are my king, whose deeds of deliverance are throughout the earth. The idea there for deliverance is his rescue, his salvations are right there. God, you're my king. One commentator that I read this week on this psalm actually suggested that this verse should be removed, perhaps, from the psalm. He's like, it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit the psalm. The tone, the mood, the what is being presented here is something different. It's like somebody's come along and stuck this really positive verse right here in the middle of this anguish and this cry for God to show up and for God to do something and for forgiveness. But on the other hand, I think that's the exact point. Actually, I think there's a reason this verse is stuck right there in the middle, in the midst of all this other stuff going on. That God, my king, interesting language used in such a psalm, my king, whose deeds of deliverance are throughout, who are in the entire earth. It's a message that in the midst of the loss and the destruction, the degradation, the exile, the pain, the loss of the temple which constituted the heart of worship, that God's salvation, God's deliverance can still be seen, can still be attained, that God's identity as king can still shine through. It's not that the verse presents a theme separate or contrary to the rest of the psalm. It's that the verse explains part of the path forward. Yes, even in the midst of all the, God, you're strong, why didn't you do something? God, you're the creator. You could have changed this. In one of those psalms, it describes how God lobbed the heads off the mythological beasts, the Leviathan. God, you cut the heads off the monsters, but you couldn't rescue us? In the midst of the how long, God, how long will it be? We have this message about, God, you're the king who works salvation in all the earth. You see, the takeaway is this. In the middle of our struggle, in the middle of the painful journey, there is the God of rescue. There, in the midst of your anguish, in the middle of your cry, is a note of trust. I've often said that you're allowed to question and shake your hand at God, as long as you do it with an open hand and not a closed hand. Okay? You know the difference? The Psalms are full of questioning God. But even in the midst of all of this, there is hope. There can be hope in destruction? Changing dancing into mourning?